whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org.
From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm Stephen John. Four people who were reported missing after a weekend boating trip on Lake Superior have been found safe. The U.S. Coast Guard says the group left Silver Bay yesterday afternoon. The trip up the North Shore was only supposed to take a few hours, so when they hadn't shown up by this morning, someone reported the vessel overdue. Rescue squads from Lake and St. Louis counties helped the Coast Guard search the area between Grand Marais and Duluth. The boat was found this morning east of there in the Apostle Islands. Authorities say at least some of the boaters are from South Dakota, and the passengers included two boys, ages 12 and 11. Few other details have been released. Early childhood education programs are getting a boost in Minnesota. The recently signed K-12 bill adds $40 million for preschool scholarships so more low-income parents can send their children to quality daycare. And it adds $134 million in funding for kindergarten. Northfield Superintendent Chris Richardson says that means his district will stop charging $3,300 a year for all-day kindergarten in 2014.
This will allow us to move to basically a free volunteer all-day program for every student.
Education officials hope the extra money for all-day kindergarten and pre-K programs will help narrow the achievement gap. As weather warms and more bikes appear on city streets, the city of Minneapolis is reminding bicyclists to obey traffic signs and signals. The city has launched a safety campaign. It includes posters in bus shelters and also includes a reminder to drivers to watch for bikes on the road. Simon Blensky is Minneapolis's city bike and pedestrian planner. He says riders can put themselves in danger by running red lights and stop signs. Plus, it's against the law.
It's actually a state statute. Bicyclists must follow all traffic control devices, just like any other road user. Whether you're walking or driving a car, bicyclists have to follow rules, just like everyone else.
Blensky says bicyclists are also required by law to use a headlight and rear deflector when riding at night. There's a flash flood watch continuing for southeastern Minnesota through Tuesday. The forecast across the state today: cloudy, chance of some showers and isolated thunderstorms in the south. 57 degrees currently in the Twin Cities. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Support for this program comes from Duall Restoration and Preservation Services of Minnesota, honoring America's servicemen and women. Duall partners with financial institutions and realtors to help families turn empty houses into homes. Online at duallservices.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the best of the Daily Circuit. Random House was all but holding the presses while author and humorist Calvin Trillin wrote his final election season jewel as the votes came in. Would he be rhyming about a Romney rout, or would he be offering up an Ohio for Obama election clincher? Well, you know how it ended, but I'll bet you haven't heard the story of the 2012 presidential campaign told quite like Trillin tells it in his book, Dogfight, the 2012 presidential campaign in verse. I spoke with Calvin Trillin back in December, and I asked him how he was able to turn around the final poems in the collection so quickly.
Well, I saved the last chapter, and otherwise I was writing in real time from the early September, I guess. And I handed it in 2 days after the election, and the book was in the stores about 10 days later.
I mean, that's pretty amazing.
I told my editor, I take back almost everything I've ever said about the inefficiency of the publishing industry.
Mm-hmm.
I reserve a few things, rants that I might need someday, but most of the things I've taken back.
So, as a wordsmith, would it have been easier to write the end of the election with a Romney wins it all, or with how you ended up writing it, which is the states come through for Obama?
Well, I'm mostly interested in whether people have good rhyme and meter in their names.
Mm-hmm.
Romney's not a good name, but Mitt's great. I don't know what I would have done if the Romneys had called their little son Willard, which is his real first name.
What's so good about Mitt?
Mitt rhymes with a lot of things, and it's short, so you don't have to worry about meter. Although some short words don't work, like Bush is a bad rhyme. Bush rhymes with tush, but that's disrespectful. I never use that. And Clinton, of course, was the orange of American presidents. His name is not good at all.
What about Obama?
Obama, unfortunately, I used up a lot of the rhymes with Osama bin Laden. Yokohama, slap your mama.
Slap your mama. You actually use that?
Slap your mama is a Louisiana phrase. Usually I've heard it applied to food, like you taste this crawfish etouffee, you'll go home and slap your mama.
And then where's Obama come into that?
Well, I can't remember how I worked him in. I guess the assumption is that you've revered your mother's cooking, but once you taste this, you'll realize it wasn't good at all and you'll slap her, which sounds violent. Of course, it wouldn't be the case in my household because I had already been in college and everything before I realized that my mother for 20 or 30 years had been serving her family nothing but leftovers.
And, that's impossible.
Well, the original meal has never been found.
Tell me how you were approaching this election real-time writing. Were you looking for the most colorful, weird moments? Were you trying to discover, hidden moments that we might have missed?
Sometimes hidden moments, but with verse, I think you pretty much need to have the subject somehow out in the air somewhere, so people have a context. It's pretty hard to go back and explain things in verse. So I was looking, occasionally something happened that nobody noticed. Like, for instance, at one time, Newt Gingrich accused Mitt Romney of being able to speak French.
I remember that.
That was, I think, a good moment, and didn't get a lot of publicity. But usually it was the big things, like the 47% speech, which that inspired a blues song called "I've Got the Mitt Thinks I'm a Moocher, a Taker Not a Maker Blues."
and sung to what?
That one was sung to nothing. I just sort of made it up. It sounded like blues. Some of them are songs like Adelson is sung to the tune of Edelweiss from The Sound of Music. And I made up a song about Ayn Rand to the tune of Blue Moon.
Yeah, you are not above grabbing other people's music
and absolutely not
putting new lyrics to them, are you?
No, I think that the earth has a limited supply of music, and so if you can recycle it, I think it's environmentally a good thing.
I think you did that interestingly with this song. Let's listen. Should we apologize to the Beatles, or should we just...
Yes, well, and that was me singing, too, just now.
Probably not.
The listeners didn't know that. I did a song called Michelle, A Serenade by Iowa Social Conservatives. This was just at the beginning of the Iowa caucuses, where I said in one couplet, to listen to long speeches is your duty, and getting there could freeze off your patootie.
So true.
Michelle, my version of Michelle is, Michelle Arbel thinks that gays will all be sent to hell. That's Michelle. Michelle Arbel thinks they're sick, but could be made all well. Yes, Michelle. She just needs to turn them toward Jesus. They're going through a phase that leads to filthy ways. But with her hubby's help, these guys could all be John Wayne. Michelle Arbel, views you have are suiting us just swell. Our Michelle.
Bachman,
yes. I later did a poem about her when she said that Hurricane Irene, which caused so much damage that year to New England, was caused by overspending, that we were spending too much money, the government. So I did a poem called Why Be So Hard on Vermont. I mean, if we're all overspending, What did Vermont have to do with this? Why did God pick on Vermont?
Good question. Do you have it open to that one?
I don't, but I could probably find it.
Why don't you try? Calvin Trillin is in the studio with us this morning, and we're talking about his process and the poetry and the prose that came out of that as he wrote basically in real time through the 2012 election. And we're hearing some of the poems, and we're hearing about the motivation for the poems.
Why be so hard on Vermont? The news report said Michelle Bachmann says Hurricane Irene was God's warning to curb excessive government spending. We know that this God's an all-powerful God. God's actions are not nonchalant. We know he can punish whomever he wants. So why be so hard on Vermont? Yes, spending increases our deficit, sure. Vermont, though, has not been avaunt the rest of the country. We all spend a lot. So why be so hard on Vermont? It's mountains, it's hipsters, it's accent, or what might tick off the great commandant? We know we're all sinners. We spend and we spend. So why be so hard on Vermont?
There's some interesting rhyming going on there. Avant and commandant.
What can I do? I only have a few words.
I mean, did that test you to the limits there?
I don't know what my limits are. I think maybe polente cognoscente were my limits.
Oh, that's good. That's really good. I forgot about that. Maybe there's a politician that you think would make a perfect subject for rhyme or prose.
Oh, well, we've had some of those. I mean, Ross Perot, a nice iambic candidate.
Oh, yeah.
And John McCain, another nice iambic candidate.
Because there's a rhythm to the name.
There's a rhythm. Because usually the problem is not just the rhyme, but the meter. And they have very nice meter. I mean, they had other problems, but they have nice meter.
Vermont, again, sounds like one of those where it's a little meter challenged.
Yeah, but Vermont worked out. I actually got terribly worried in 2008. It's hard to believe now, but before people got organized for the primaries in 2008, one of the people mentioned as a possible Democratic candidate was Rod Blagojevich.
That's right.
The governor of Illinois.
Boy, does that seem strange.
Well, I thought so. Yeah, it does seem strange that he was considered. But I was terribly worried about what if he became president? I have to rhyme Blagojevich all the time. But then later I wrote a poem. It turned out you could rhyme Blagojevich. This is called On the Auctioning Off of Barack Obama's Senate Seat. It seemed to Rod Blagojevich a powerful appointment which was his to make should make him rich. His plan turned out to have a glitch. Perhaps the feds had flipped a snitch. So much for Rod Blagojevich.
That's great. You can just take that little itch at the end and
itch at the end,
go
with it. That's right.
So really the difficult thing is if somebody has some weird hanging consonant.
Yeah, Romney's not good. I mean, there are a lot of poems about Romney. There's a poem about Romney going to Minnesota and to Michigan and saying that the trees are the right height. You know, he had a little trouble.
That really happened.
It did.
Lest anyone think Calvin Trillin made that up.
He had a little trouble relating to human beings. And this is a poem called I Thought That I Would Never See a Paul Who Loved the Height of Trees. And the quote is, I love this state. It seems right here the trees are the right height. Away from here I find no trees that please, no trees at such a perfect height as these. For me, I cannot ever be at ease with trees that grow no higher than one's knees, or two tall trees that splinter in a freeze. Wisconsin sure has bragging rights on cheese, and California's rich in Cantonese, and Colorado's where to take your skis. Connecticut, of course, has Lyme disease. At none of these am I prepared to sneeze, but here we have the perfect height of trees. I know that I will never see a sight as lovely as a tree whose height is right.
You have no shame about stealing from anyone, do you?
No.
No?
No.
Why?
I think of it as a sort of a secondary use. That was, of course, Joyce Kilmer.
Yes.
The poet laureate of New Jersey.
You think of it as recycling.
Homage.
An homage.
Homage. These are homage. Usually there's some kind of apologies. I did one on the Tea Party that is to the tune of Matchmaker. And it's from Fiddler on the Roof, Matchmaker.
I'm trying to imagine what that could
be. Tea Party yeah. Instead of Matchmaker. But it all has to do with the meter. Tea Party is the right meter for Matchmaker.
So you're disappointed that Sarah Palin didn't get in because, boy, she's got it all, right?
Well, she does. She would have been good, but I must say I was a little concerned that there was only going to be one primary fight, just the Republicans, because in 2008 we had both parties, which gave me a lot more material.
Yeah.
Except that the Republican primary candidates were so, what shall I say, colorful.
Mm.
That it turned out to be okay,
and it went on and on. So you
and it went on and
much.
On. And I was always worried that it was going to end, but then, and then somebody would appear from nowhere, from the back of the pack. I mean, Santorum, Gingrich, and I wrote. There's a little prose in this book, what we call a pause for prose, and one of those pieces is called Callista Gingrich. Aware that her husband has cheated on and left two seriously ill wives, tries to make light of a bad cough.
It's great.
He was good copy, Newton. And
she had to have been too.
Yes, she was.
to Michael in Faribault. Hi, Michael.
Well, hello there, and love listening to Calvin. I would suggest maybe a local flavor of making a poem with R.T. Rybeck, but R.T. is relatively rhymeable, as is Rybeck, I think. So I'm suggesting that as a local flavor.
There's one of those Scandinavian-type names.
I would probably go with R.T. I used a lot of first names, not just Mitt, Newt, Rick Santorum, Rick Perry. And Perry also was a good rhyme. He had great hair, Rick Perry, but also they said the space beneath the hair was airy. So he rhymes very well.
I want to play a moment of inspiration, I think, for you from the primary campaign with Rick Perry.
Commerce, education, and
EPA?
EPA, there you go. No, okay.
Let's talk deposition.
Seriously? Is EPA the one you were talking about? Or?
No, sir. We were talking about the agencies of government. EPA needs to be rebuilt.
But
there's
you
no doubt about
but
that.
But you can't name the third one?
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see, I can't, the third, sorry, oops.
You know, it feels like it goes on a lot longer than when
yes.
You're listening to it back, doesn't it? It's painful.
It does. It is, I thought it was painful too.
So
and
painful.
And oddly enough, you know, anybody could have had that. And that could have happened to anybody.
Right.
That kind of brain freeze moment. We've all done that. But it happened that it sort of fit in with the idea that the space beneath the hair was airy.
And so you wrote about it.
I did. I think I marked the wrong one.
I think it's page
32. Here it is.
Yeah, page 32.
Oh, well, 32 was when he entered the race. But this one in 34 said the biggest gaffe had happened in November when Perry in debate could not remember the third of three departments he would toss into the scrap heap once he was the boss. Then he said, oops. With that word, it was clear the White House was a place he'd not get near. All three department workers could relax, for he'd become the butt of comics cracks. He held out for a while, 2 months at most. But from that moment, Rick's campaign was toast.
There's also a little mini poem in there. So what's with the cowboy boots, Rick?
Oh, yeah.
Which is fun.
This is called, So what's with the cowboy boots, Rick? You say you're the real thing from Texas, an Aggie, not someone from Yale. While claiming to be a straight shooter, you plant a boot high on a bale. 'Twas cotton that grew on your farm, Rick. You didn't grow up on the range. No horses are used to plant cotton, so cowboy boots seem mighty strange. No phony, then alter your costume. Although they lack cowboy boot zing, if you have a sodbuster background, bib overalls might be the thing.
I like that sodbuster that you worked in there. It's pretty cool.
Oh, I got that from those Western movies. They're just a bunch of sodbusters, and we're going to run them off.
Oh, to the phones to Anthony in Coon Rapids. Hi, Anthony.
Hello.
Hi.
Two names, same man, everybody's favorite mayor, Rudolph Giuliani. I'll hang up and listen.
Oh, have you written about him?
I have written about Rudolph Giuliani, and I did rhyme. Well, I rhyme Rudy a lot, but I think I also rhyme Giuliani. I wish I could think of the rhyme now. I may think of it by the end of our time.
You've talked about meter. It has a kind of nice.
No, it's a nice
meter to it.
It has an. I think it's a very nice name, Giuliani. It has a nice bounce to it.
Right.
I'm not sure that it fits the man very well.
This is
the guy who said he was getting divorced from his wife on television before he told her. So we're not talking about someone of very high ethical standards here.
Back to the phones here to Marty in Wisconsin. Hi, Marty.
Good morning.
Hi.
Mr. Trillin, your pieces in The Nation are always the first thing I turn to when we get that magazine. And I've memorized three poems in my life, one by Shel Silverstein, one by Emily Dickinson, and one by Calvin Trillin. The Battle of Private Lynch years ago was a big hit when I could recite that at parties. But I'm wondering, please tell me you've written a poem about Scott Walker, our governor.
No, I didn't do that, but I'm very happy to hear that those are the three people whose poems you've memorized, because now people will say something like Silverstein, Dickinson, and Trillin in that crowd. I like that idea. Now, I think it's fair to say that's the first time I've been mentioned in connection with Emily Dickinson.
Savor it.
although I'll probably talk tonight about my connection with T.S. Eliot, who's... We're the Missouri School of Poetry.
Ah, well, what is the Missouri School of Poetry?
T.S. Eliot and me.
That's it. And you two are connected by other ways?
Well,
in any other way besides?
Yes. We both use German occasionally in poem. He pointed out when George W. Bush picked an old retainer to be attorney general that Alberto Gonzalez rhymes with loyal Uber Alles and other foreign languages. He uses Sanskrit. I don't use Sanskrit much.
How come?
I was one of those kids who just sort of daydreamed during Sanskrit class in Kansas City, kind of staring out the window. And I use Yiddish some, but he never did that.
I'm kind of partial to a poem that is called Mitt Visits Foreign Lands and Not to Visit His Money, because I feel like it has kind of a swing to it. There's this is going to sound kind of weird. There's a limerick kind of swing to that poem.
Okay, well, I'll read that.
All right.
The Mitster, while taking a three-nation swing, showed talent for saying the very wrong thing. He teed off our English friends lickety-split. The tabloids in London town called him a twit. Though Mitt said his motives were never ulterior, he seemed to be calling the Arabs inferior. In English and Arabic venom Mitt bathed. 'Twas only in Poland he came out unscathed. His trip meant to show foreign policy cred, because of Mitt's gaffe was a model instead of what not to say when abroad one doth roam. So here's the consensus. He should have stayed home.
See, there once was a man from...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I hadn't
See, it's kind of
that,
got that.
But...
Yeah. To the phones to Ryan in Wells, Minnesota. Hey, Ryan.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thank you so much for taking my call this morning. Mr. Trillin, your fan base has now grown. I've never heard of you before, but I'm completely delighted by this program.
Thank you.
I'll be picking up some of your literature. I was wondering if you had ever done anything, which I'm sure you probably have, on Bill, Hillary, and Lovely Monica. I actually write some comedy folk and rock music myself, and it always starts with verse, so this is just wonderful, and I'll take my comments up here. Thank you so much.
Well, yes, during that unpleasantness, around the time that Hillary Clinton was said to be taking over the defense, and right at the beginning, she went on the Today program and everything. And
the right wing conspiracy.
I had a problem, of course, with that name, Clinton, which is not a good rhyme or has bad meter. So I had to use what we used to call her maiden name. We don't use that term anymore, I don't think. I think we say name of origin or slave name, something like that. And I wrote a poem that was, "And so it's up to our Ms. Rodham to prove Bill's White House isn't Sodom. It's left to this adroit senora to show that it is just Gomorrah."
And it'll live in infamy.
Well, we'll see.
Listener on Twitter says, "Mr. Trillin may steal when he may wish. He stands on the shoulders of giants."
Oh, thank you.
Is that how you think about it?
Yeah, shoulders of giants. Very well put. I couldn't have said it better myself.
To the phones to Bill in St. Paul. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. My question is about the nature of social commentary and criticism. Some of the most insightful commentators we have are political cartoonists because they make a point with a simple graphic and just a couple of words in a thought balloon. Then we get to the people like you who take us on these wonderful little stories, wonderful little rides, but boy, you guys can get to the heart of a hypocrisy or a contradiction or a problem very, very quickly. We all laugh at them and enjoy them very much, but all too often people don't take humor as seriously as they should, like the UK does. What do you think it would take for humorists to become considered serious commentators, serious, insightful commentators in the in press and in the media?
Sometimes some of my colleagues say they taught a class in journalism school or something, and they were appalled to find that most people in the class were getting their news from Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. And I said, I don't find that appalling at all. His news is pretty good. So I think he's taken seriously. It's funny you say that because I think of these pieces of verse closer to political cartoons than anything, closer to the sort of thing that Herb Block used to do as opposed to a long essay. And there's a Woody Allen quote. I don't know if Woody Allen really said that, but that in America, humorists always have to sit at the children's table. And in the first place, in my house in Christmas, you really have to. People fought to get at the children's table. I mean, I finally told my older daughter she couldn't sit there anymore. She was 35 years old, and they're good food fights, and also Mark Twain would be there. So I think he's taken seriously, and in many ways, not only from his novels, but if you read some of his after-dinner speeches, he was a stand-up.
You mentioned the Clint Eastwood incident at the Republican convention, and I wondered if there was so much material there that you considered just for one moment giving him a whole poem to himself.
I thought of it, but then so much had been said about it. But I do, and I also, this is a good example of what this caller is talking about. I thought one of the best comments on the first debate was by Barry Blitt, who did the cover for this book, who did a cover for The New Yorker that showed Romney talking to an empty chair in the first debate.
Right.
So sometimes a political commentator who can draw can get at things pretty quickly.
You ever wish you can you draw?
I cannot draw at all, no.
You ever wish you could have?
I'd rather be able to sit down and play the piano, but yeah.
If we're going to talk about gifts
if
that
we're
we'd
talk
like to
about,
have.
Like gifts that are just visited upon us without any effort, yes.
To the phones to Dan in Minneapolis. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. Mr. Trillin, I'm wondering if you can wax nostalgic a little bit at all about George Herbert Walker Bush.
Oh, I had some trouble with his administration because there really weren't any great juicy scandals in his administration. I think maybe one guy got indicted of all of his cabinet people and everything, and I think he turned out to be acquitted. And I sort of, when George H.W. Bush left, I actually wanted to write a poem about him. Again, Bush is not a good rhyme, but fortunately he had a lot of middle names. So I had a poem that was, "Farewell to you, George Herbert Walker, though never treasured as a talker, your predicates were often prone to wander nounless off alone. You did your best in your own way, the way of Greenwich Country Day. So just relax and take your ease and never order Japanese."
Oh, that's so good. There's so many inside jokes in there.
Well, inside jokes except for newspaper readers who are old enough to remember this.
I remember it. You're talking about when he threw up on the
on the Japanese prime minister.
Would you read the last poem that is dedicated to the state of Ohio?
Yeah, Ohio is, as you know, got a lot of traffic from politicians and reporters. It's called "Ohio Ends a Swing State Phase." Of course, it's an honor to be called by all the state that elects the commander-in-chief. But now that it's over, the sound around here is not lots of weeping, but sighs of relief.
I notice you don't use a lot of alliteration.
Not too much alliteration. And I sort of, deadline poets sort of frown on metaphor.
Why?
Well, we think it's kind of sissy stuff, metaphor, alliteration, that sort of thing. When I say we, I am a member of something called the International Deadline Poets Organization, IDPO, and there are two of us.
Who's the other one?
The other one is a fine, very talented man named John Alamang, who is with the Globe and Mail in Toronto. And he's still with the Globe and Mail, but his poems don't run anymore. So I always say, his membership would be hanging by a thread, except that would be a metaphor, and we discourage metaphors.
IDPO. It's such a great name. To Jennifer in Eden Prairie. Hi, Jennifer.
I wondered if you considered writing a poem about Stephen Colbert and his super PAC, A Better Tomorrow Tomorrow, or his run as the president of South Carolina.
I haven't written a poem about that. I did mention him in a poem called in this book called The Lamentation of the Late Night Comics. This is when Herman Cain left, and each verse has one of them in tears lamenting the fact that Herman Cain's not in the race anymore. And the last line is, "Can we have Donald Trump back, please?"
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Best of the Daily Circuit. We'll be back in just a minute.
Support for this program comes from Boreal Natives, a division of Prairie Restorations, dedicated to restoring native plant communities in northern Minnesota. On the web at prairieresto.com.
Last week on Morning Edition, we heard what it sounds like when laws are made.
Yes, go ahead and applaud. That's right. Go ahead and applaud.
Stop.
And what draws one family to a rustic lakeside cabin.
And when you get here, it's just so wonderful. It's just such a getaway, and everything that you have to do at home is left behind, and it's just a letting go responsibility.
I'm Phil Picardi. Understand our world by listening to Morning Edition weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m.
I'm Tom Weber, and you're listening to the Best of the Daily Circuit. Poet Tracy Smith can draw the line between poetry and space. Her book of poems, called Life on Mars, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2012. It was published by Gray Wolf Press right here in the Twin Cities. I had the chance to speak with Smith during a visit she made to Minnesota. A lot of her writings explore the very deep connection she had to her late father, Floyd, an engineer who worked on the Hubble telescope.
To be really honest with you, it didn't really fit inside my imagination when I was a kid. This was like the early 80s. I was like 8 years old, I think, when he took that job. And I knew that it was something that had to do with space and images. But I feel like maybe the world was so new to me, and I felt like maybe that was the moment where I was realizing I was an individual in it. So the idea of distant space was something that just was so beyond the wonder that was at hand, that I feel like I didn't ask him enough when I had access to him. But when I was writing these poems and thinking about space as a lens through which to look at human life, it kind of was buried in my memory. And then suddenly I realized, wait a minute, my father had this job for a big stretch of my childhood, and this is what he did. And it really opened up another set of concerns for me. I was grieving his death, and to be able to put him in the same context as so many of these other poems, just it felt really helpful, and I was grateful for them.
He's working on this thing that produces such awesome images and answers a lot of questions about, you know, these huge, universal topics. Looking back, did you think, oh, wait, he was trying?
Oh, yeah. You know, I remember he was excited about this, and he would bring home, you know, these projected images of what the device was going to look like. And I remember him saying, oh, when we, you know, when we're in the room with the equipment, we kind of scrub down like surgeons. There's even a line in one of the poems that's like that. So it's not true that I didn't know anything about what he did.
Right.
But it seemed kind of like part of this large and distant context that I didn't know how to unravel exactly. And I remember when I was in college, those first, there was a book that came out with some of the first clear images. And I remember the pride with which he was showing that to me. But I also was still living with the echo of the, you know, the first images that came back, and feeling, you know, that residual disappointment and maybe a little bit of shame from that. And that also probably had a lot to do with the fact that I was 19 years old and kind of going through that age of individuation or rebellion or something like that.
What was the, it was shame?
There was a problem with one of the lenses. Yeah. And so the first images were blurred. There was aberration. And it seemed like, oh, this magic feat that we've been talking about for years and waiting for, you know, more than a decade, didn't work. And of course, it was a problem that was resolved. But that first sense of, oh, no, was something that
we messed up. Something's wrong.
Yeah.
This is fascinating, though, because we hear, like, for example, right now, there's the new rover on Mars, and we're seeing these beautiful images coming back, and you know, we are struck by the science that's happening, I guess you could say, if we want to nerd out about that for a minute. But what you're kind of bringing to us is that rare story, that because you're in the vast minority of people whose families are directly affected by the day-to-day work on the machines that bring us that science.
Yeah. Well, since this book has come out, I've heard from a few different kids of engineers and scientists just through email, and they talk about a similar sense of just pride that someone that they love has, you know, touched this device or contributed to it in some way. Last winter, I read at the Space Telescope Science Institute and met a lot of the engineers that are working, you know, on these images now. And one astronaut who had been in space to do a repair to the machine, and it just kind of blew me away that this thing that lives in my imagination, or these images that speak to my limited sense of, you know, scientific understanding, but mostly to this, you know, the place where story and image lives inside of my imagination, to talk to people who had a really quantifiable relationship to this thing, and who are manipulating it. And it was kind of funny, the conversation that we had back and forth, because they often think about what they're doing as data. You know, these are figures, they're images, they're numbers that we're working on. And it's easy for them to forget what they represent to people in the world. So it was kind of a nice, you know, we didn't mirror each other, but I think we shed a different kind of light on the different stakes that we have.
Do you think about why you didn't follow your father into science, into engineering?
I don't think I had a choice.
Really?
I don't think I really had the aptitude for that kind of like quantitative reasoning. My father was also a really voracious reader, and that's what I remember him pushing me toward. And you know, that was a vocabulary that we could share, but the numbers, I don't know, maybe I surrendered to that thing that happens to a lot of girls, which is, I don't have the mind for math and science. But I did feel like poetry was something that somehow my father was connected to just because he loved it.
He did. Mm-hmm. He loved poetry as well.
Yeah.
What kind of poetry did your father like to read?
Oh, my father was a classicist. So he would, I remember books on our shelves, poems of Wordsworth and the poems of, you know, the sonnets of Shakespeare and, you know, Edgar Allan Poe. So he was, you know, he believed that those were voices that we needed to hear and memorize even.
So that was your introduction then too?
Yeah. Whenever I was bored, he would say, why don't you go read the poems of Wordsworth? Sometimes I did.
What's your favorite Wordsworth?
Oh, don't ask me that.
Fair enough. Was this a requirement, I guess, on your part that this book then be science-related or science-themed because you wanted to honor your father?
Well, I actually started writing the poems that were thinking about the universe as and some of the poems that were borrowing from science fiction. I wanted a distancing device, and I guess that's really what the genre provides, that would help me look at life on the ground and kind of extrapolate from the culture that we live in to the culture that we're probably laying the groundwork for. So those poems were the ones that came first. And then it was a couple of years after those first poems got started that my father became ill and ended up passing away somewhat unexpectedly. And the grief that I was feeling was obviously going to become a part of what I was writing. And then I made the connection between his work and that, you know, it's not a terrain, but that zone of space. And
right. How did you get from voracious reader, love of reading, all of this, knowing you're not going to go into science, to poetry?
I always thought I would be some kind of writer when I was growing up. And at first I didn't know what that meant, but I knew that I liked reading and I liked writing little rhymes down on scraps of paper. And then as I got older, I thought I would become a journalist because that made sense. That was a job that somebody who loves to write could have. But when I got to college, the classes that were most interesting to me were the literature courses. And I remember finally getting to the point in one of my survey English classes where we were reading 20th century poetry. And I felt like I was in the space with a voice that was speaking directly to me and teaching me how to look at the world in a way that it could become totally transformed, and the things that seemed small and familiar and inconsequential could yield these really astounding truths or discoveries. And I just kind of got bitten by it. And I realized that there were lots of poets who were alive, who were writing, and I could hear them read their work and hear them talk about their work. And suddenly I understood that that's what I wanted to do with my life. I didn't know how I would do that, but I had this goal.
Not exactly a lucrative
industry
to go into, is it?
I've been there for some of the early conversations I had with my parents about that vocation. I think they were worried.
I mean, was the declaration literally, I want to be a poet?
Yeah, it was. I know it's like kind of when I look back, I realize how pretentious it was because I wasn't just saying it to myself, but I was telling my parents. And I wasn't just telling my parents, I was declaring it to my friends, like, I'm a poet now. And it means I'm going to stay home tonight and work on these poems, which are very important to me. But I feel like I needed to voice it because I felt like that was the first step to making this thing that seemed impossible or almost impossible likely or, you know, potentially real.
You said in one thing I read that you have said something along the lines of poems are essential to democracy. You know, I think that's a bold statement. I don't know that everyone who's listening is going to agree with you.
I think there are a lot of people who don't agree with that. But if I back up and say that a relationship with language that is not satisfied with vagueness and that pushes for meaning on a variety of levels and that seeks language for the feelings and impulses that we have that we don't always understand, I feel like those things people could agree are important to a deep engagement with the world and with experience and with others. And then those things, I think, are things that are easy to identify as elements of a functioning democracy, where people are concerned with what is being said and why and by whom, what it really means, what kind of spin has been put on it. And they're also concerned with what is happening to people who I know and to the people who I don't know, and how is the language that I'm responsible for producing or that I consent to, and the acts that such words set into motion, how does that affect others? So I feel like it might not be the most obvious path, but I feel like it is a path that leads to a different kind of engagement in society.
Isn't there a risk, though, especially within poetry, and I single out poetry specifically, that what you're writing, which is so internal and personal, becomes so obtuse to the outside world that you're in no way achieving what you just described?
Well, people have different ideas about what a poem, how a poem ought to behave. I like to think that a good poem, no matter how it behaves or how it's built, teaches you how to read it. And part of what I'm saying is that the sensitivity that a reader must develop in order to become adept at reading poems and getting something out of them is a sensitivity that can be applied to day-to-day experience as well. So you're not just looking at the surface of things and drawing easy conclusions from them or saying, I didn't get that, and walking away from it. You're looking and you're saying, what is presented and what can I do to understand it and also to speak back to it?
So that's what you're doing on those Friday nights when you were telling your friends, I got to stay home.
I was doing, you know, baby steps, but I was learning what I wanted to say and how to say it. Sometimes I feel like, you know, we often think that our thoughts find language, but sometimes I think that language can lead us to recognizing what we think and feel. The things that we're not necessarily aware of, maybe those unconscious feelings and impressions.
Speaking here with Tracy Smith, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, author of a collection of poems called Life on Mars. Will you read one of those?
Sure, I'd love to. This is a poem called It and Company, and a large part of the book is taking up the, you know, the mystery of space and what we belong to and asking, you know, what it's made of. And this is one of the poems that does that. It and Company. We are a part of it, not guests. Is it us or what contains us? How can it be anything but an idea, something teetering on the spine of the number I? It is elegant, but coy. It avoids the blunt ends of our fingers as we point. We have gone looking for it everywhere, in Bibles and bandwidth, blooming like a wound from the ocean floor. Still, it resists the matter of false versus real. Unconvinced by our zeal, it is unappeasable. It is like some novels, vast and unreadable.
You could easily read that and not really know what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, it shifts shapes. You know, there are a lot of poems in this book where I found myself using God as a noun. And I didn't think that was what I was wanting to do. But I realized, you know, the questions that were spinning around about not only grief and loss and whatever I wanted to imagine might constitute the afterlife, but also some of the dark and perplexing dynamics that we're tangled up in here between, you know, family members or neighbors or nations. Sometimes we like to imagine that there's this other larger force that's either involved or observing. And it sometimes felt more satisfying than the version of God that many of us are connected to.
I think, though, people, it and maybe the word thing, I mean, these are words that people just kind of insert when they don't really know what they're trying to say. That thing, the it.
Yeah. There's a place where metaphor is really helpful, right? It's the thing that helps us to describe or you know, liken one thing that we do understand to something that we don't understand or haven't experienced. But then there's a place where metaphor kind of like breaks down. And for me, I was imagining these, you know, like, when you look at those images of space, you're looking at the beginning of time, and you're also, you feel like you're looking at the future. And when you think about where we are in, you know, that spectrum, it's mind-boggling. And so after a certain point, metaphors kind of just stopped feeling helpful. Maybe they came in and out of use for me. And when they were least accessible for me, I liked the vast, unknowable blankness of something like it and what seemed to stand behind it.
I also have to say I appreciate the references to David Bowie.
Ah.
I don't know where that – Life on Mars, of course. There is a song by that name. There's a whole – Don't You Wonder Sometimes is a poem all about David Bowie. Where did that come from?
Oh, it came from my actual love of David Bowie and my envy of the imaginative space that he kind of shared with the world, especially, you know, the glam rock era, I think is my favorite Bowie still. And that otherworldliness that, you know, maybe it gave shape to a lot of the slippery or surprising desires that we feel. I just wanted to feel like I was in conversation with him.
It also helps that he wrote a heck of a number of songs about space and travel and all
that. I mean,
that.
It's also, hey, let's face it, someone of my generation, I think it's hard to think about space and without thinking about a lot of science fiction imagery, but also, especially that which Bowie has kind of like sung into being. So I wanted to feel like maybe we were doing a duet or something.
If you were to give a generic, I'll generically name it, the state of poetry speech and declare, I feel the state of poetry is this. And I'm bringing this up because we interviewed recently Buddy Guy, who made a point as we ended the interview of saying, the blues are dying and I'm going to do anything I can before I die to keep them going. Mm-hmm. And I'm not suggesting poetry is dying, but I'm curious your take on what is the state of poetry?
Yeah. Well, I guess I would say that poetry is not dying. And one of the reasons I feel that way is because the state of contemporary American poetry is extremely vibrant. I remember, you know, 20 years ago when I was a student feeling like there were about 10 names and that were, you know, prominent and that marked what was happening in American poetry. And a spectrum that was probably just, you know, a small fraction of the spectrum that has now been recognized as, you know, contributing powerfully and equally and necessarily to the whole of American poetry. And I think that there are a lot of organizations like Kaveh Khanum or the Asian American Writers Workshop that are responsible for feeding the talent and the appetite for poetry that a lot of young would-be writers have, and also supporting and celebrating the writers whose work has really made a big difference, I think, in that larger literary conversation. And then I also think that partially because the poems that are being written and published right now are so diverse, there are a lot of things that I feel safe about. I feel like, you know, like a poet like Tahimba Jess or Patricia Smith, who are both writing poems that have so much to do with music and the blues and the not only the aural evidence of that phenomenon, but also the lives inside of it, not only the lives who, you know, built it, but the lives affected by it. I feel like Buddy Guy can feel a little bit safe that, you know, the blues are not going to die too quickly. And if for some reason the music stops, it's not going to be forgotten. It's been memorialized and also maybe also invigorated by the way that other genres are examining it. And, you know, if I wrote a book that is kind of science fiction-y, then, you know, there are 10 other books that are pointing in other unexpected directions that tell me that, you know, poets are using the tool of the poem to examine all of these different and unlikely facets of experience.
I'm Tom Weber, and you've been listening to the best of the Daily Circuit.
It was Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Tracy Smith here on about her collection of poems, Life in Mars. Stick around. We're going to hear from veterans of World War II next hour. And by the way, Carrie Miller is going to be at the World Science Festival in New York this week to interview some of the top scientists in the world. Special 11 o'clock hour World Science Festival week coming up all this week on the Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.
Support for this program comes from the Ordway Center for Performing Arts, presenting Buddy, the Buddy Holly Story. This jukebox musical is designed for the whole family and includes over 30 Buddy Holly hits, June 11th to 16th only. More at ordway.org.
It is 12 noon now at Minnesota Public Radio News, 91.1 KNOW, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Listen live with our free mobile apps available for Android and iPhone. Thanks for tuning in and taking us along on your Memorial Day Monday, May 20th.